Welcome to Radio at Firehouse.com. Real issues, real answers, real firefighters. Firehouse.com brings you the leaders of the nation's fire, rescue, and EMS services, the top columnists and educators, and today's most important issues, headlines, and comments. Listen right on your desktop or download and listen on the go to Firehouse.com.
With less money and fewer firefighters, departments have to use their people in the smartest and safest ways. So the next time you're speccing an apparatus, think manual and remote control monitors. Why, TFT practically reinvented radio frequency handheld controls for monitors, flowing from 15 up to 2,000 gallons per minute. Since every firefighter counts, so does every purchase. We can help maximize your team's Firestream's performance today. Visit us at www.tft.com or give us a call at 800-348-2686.
Hello and welcome to the Apparatus Architects, Michael Wilbur and Tom Shand. And for our December podcast, depending upon where you are in the country and listening to us, unless you happen to be down in the deep south, there's a chance that if you look out your window, you're going to see ice, snow, probably not anything in a liquid, but more than likely a frozen liquid combination. And that's going to be some of the topics that we're going to be talking about today. Our rundown is we're once again going to open up at the top of the show with Brother Mike taking us through some of the recent accidents and incidents. And as we begin to close the books on calendar year 2008, we find ourselves not doing any better in December than we did in January. We're then going to try to go through a good little stack of questions that we've received from our listeners. And once again, we would encourage you, if you have anything that you would like us to handle and answer on the air, please send those questions into podcast@firehouse.com, and we'll go through several of those. Then we're then going to talk about, since we're in the month of December, something that's very appropriate, cold weather operations, both responding to, returning from alarms, what you can do to keep your apparatus little bit less trouble-free at the scene of an incident, and most importantly, what you can do to prepare for that when the apparatus is still sitting on the floor. And then we're going to finish up with Mike giving us an update on what's going on with the seatbelt initiative, and then some final thoughts. So with that, Brother Mike, what are we doing here, and what's newsworthy since we last gathered in terms of who's racking up what on the streets? And not to egg you on a little bit, but the FDNY in the city of New York has had a couple of fairly serious accidents here within the last couple of weeks. What's some commentary that you have on those?
Yeah, well, earlier this month, Tom, ladder 12, 95-foot Seagrave tower ladder, and squad 18, both Manhattan companies, collided at an intersection in Manhattan. It caused a couple of serious injuries, and it's just one of several. And interesting to note about the ones that we've had of late is that when fire trucks hit fire trucks and buses hit fire trucks, the damage is just so much more severe than if we were to just hit a car. Or a car hit us, as it were. And so the damage was pretty severe on both the apparatus. The officer of the squad was hurt fairly badly, as was the driver. And again, much to the credit of Seagrave in the construction of their cabs, with the steel front bumpers that you so often mention, the injuries could have been far worse had the apparatus not been equipped with those steel bumpers and had not had that steel reinforced custom cab. They were going to a gas leak, and just really no excuse. Somebody obviously in that instance had to blow through a red light, one of the apparatus, to hit the other one. And more perhaps on that later as the investigation continues on that. And then just a few days ago in the borough of Brooklyn, six firefighters from Ladder Company 103 were rushed to a hospital, two with serious but non-life-threatening injuries. The driver of Ladder 103 was temporarily pinned Meanwhile, 19 people on the bus were shaken up and were being treated. The front of the bus suffered extensive front-end damage, and the windows were blown out in the city bus. And the driver, from what I have learned, took the worst of that. And what makes it, not that one response is any better or any worse than another, but when you do this kind of collateral damage responding to a car fire, it really has to make you stop and think and wonder, you know, what exactly are we trying to do? This is what we call in FDNY lingo a 5-7 signal, where we send a 5, one engine, and a 7, one ladder, to a report of a car fire. To crash into a bus, and regardless of whose fault it is, it's just takes a minute of pause to just define what we were trying to do. And we know that driving apparatus is risky business, but certainly we have to do that risk-benefit analysis, and are the risks that we're about to undertake worth some kind of benefit? And if we can't answer a definite yes to that, then why are we taking the risk? You know,
Mike, you mentioned about the collateral damage, and not to downplay the seriousness of any injuries to the members, or in the case of Squad 18 and the truck, that there was a fire truck on fire truck accident, and there wasn't any civilians in that particular incident. But to me, just thinking about the other collateral damages in a career department, what mark that may place on the unit driver or the officer, even if they were doing everything in the right, there still is a little bit of, I would think, just natural, maybe, you know, a little bit of hesitation by the other guys to think about, geez, this guy just racked up the rig, and yeah, we walked away from this one, but there may be a little bit of hesitation about, you know, entrusting your personal safety to that individual, and a little bit of either casual or maybe not so casual blame that goes around, you know, after the initial trauma of the incident's over. And then to me, just thinking from the overall perspective, now in both of those incidents, and certainly with the other one with ladder 103, you know, you're not driving back to the fire station in those rigs. So even I'm thinking, Mike, and correct me if I'm wrong, but in FDNY, if your engine or the truck is out of service, yeah, you're going to go into a reserve unit and might not be as new and might not be as great, but you're, quote, sliding into despair. But then when you start thinking about, like, the squad company, I think they only have, like, maybe one spare that may have already been out. So now you're really riding in something that's dramatically different from what you've got. And with the level of seriousness of those incidents, you're not sending that rig to a body shop and having to come back, you know, in the next week or two, or maybe even the next month or two. So, you know, every tour that you go back into the station and you see, you know, as you walk in the door, you're still riding on that, you know, politely speaking, again, and no detriment to the FDNY here, but with most departments, that their second-line apparatus is called second-line exactly for that reason. It's not good enough to be in front-line, so it certainly is older and may be in somewhat less of a better mechanical condition. It's like an everyday reminder when you walk into the station that here's this rig and what the heck happened, and you kind of relive it all over again.
Right, yeah, that's absolutely correct, and that's without killing or seriously hurting somebody. And, you know, from the work that I've done over the course of my career with the driving accidents, that I've had the opportunity to interview and to counsel and to interact with any number of people that have taken fire trucks and ambulances and killed or hurt people, and forever their lives will never be the same, and in most cases that their lives are just completely ruined. You know, it's all excitement and fun driving around with lights and sirens until somebody gets hurt. And then we pay a terrible, terrible cost. So that was, you know, that's really a good point. And another point that you brought up there that made me think, the same night that Squad 18 wrecked, I believe that a fellow friend of ours in the FDNY told me that it was Squad 252 that also wrecked that night. Well, again, like you had pointed out, that with a limited number of those specialty units in reserve, One of those companies may have actually ended up with just a straight pumper, and only half of the normal complement of equipment that they would normally carry would be on that because they just don't have the compartmentation that the squad apparatus would. So that's just another, that there's just so much surrounding these accidents, that this collateral damage that we don't often get into and speak about, and just really a tragedy. We're lucky that nobody was seriously hurt in either of those events, but just gives one pause to think about what we're really trying to accomplish and what we're trying to do. And you look at car fires, and a modern-day car fire, does it make any difference whether you get there in a minute or 10 minutes? If it's a working car fire, is the fire department going to seriously alter the outcome of that car fire? And the answer is no. It's just going to be a molten ball of plastic at the end of the day. And how many times have we seen where it's confirmed that there are no people in the car, or that we have perhaps a chief or officer on the scene that confirms there's nobody in the car, and still we're wrecking apparatus on the way to that scene? And again, it goes back to that risk-benefit analysis. What are the risks? And they seem to be immense with each passing day. And what benefit do we hope to gain by, you know, blowing a stop sign or a red light, and we find out that there's nothing to be gained at all, that 30 seconds or that minute just doesn't make a difference? And in my career, I can honestly say that even with fatal fires, I can't remember one where a minute, one way or the other, you know, really made a difference. That's just so rare when we talk about time and responding and having to rush and all that. Generally, when we went to a fatal fire, most days the people were dead before we ever left the firehouse. And those people that we saved, they would have been viable another minute from the time that we saved them. And so this idea of just rushing around and disregarding traffic laws and regulations is just really foolhardy.
I understand also that there's been a couple of incidents recently. In fact, one that just happened just, I guess, within the last 24 hours with apparatus being hit by other vehicles out on the interstate. And any comment on some of those particular incidents?
Yeah, thank you, Tom. There was one in North Carolina in Guilford County. They were struck while operating on I-85/I-40. They called communications urgently and identified themselves and said that they had been struck. It appears that the apparatus was in the left lane or left shoulder, blocking for a previous crash. Initial reports are that the civilian vehicle was wedged under the truck and the left side of the Jersey wall, the Jersey barrier, and that person was not pinned or hurt. Just the door was jammed. The rig had to be towed from the scene, and as with most cases when this happened. And then there was another really hellacious one. Just yesterday, in the state of New Jersey, four New Jersey police troopers escaped certain deaths when a tractor trailer plowed into their accident scene on I-80. The troopers, along with firefighters, were operating at a crash when a tractor trailer lost control just before 5:30, and the tractor trailer skidded into another vehicle that spun out on the icy lanes. The rig then smashed into the blocking fire apparatus and two state police cruisers and took them all out that had responded to that previous crash. Others, along with the four troopers, escaped serious injury, and New Jersey State Police officials believe it worked out well because the fire apparatus was able to block their patrol cars from taking the direct hit. The police cruisers were totaled, but they weren't. What's interesting about those two case studies that just happened within the last week, if our listeners noticed, Tom, that each of the fire trucks assumed a backing position, and would really like to congratulate the folks at ResponderSafety.com, Steve Austin, Dr. Harry Carter, Ron Moore, Jack Sullivan, among others in that group, have just done a phenomenal job of heightening the awareness of first responders and teaching how to position apparatus and how to operate on the nation's roadways and highways and how to protect ourselves and how to protect that scene. And although these accidents were horrendous, the results could have been far worse had the advice and had the program that ResponderSafety.com puts on that those lessons were not heeded. And so just want to congratulate those folks for just doing a phenomenal job. And those guys are just helping to save firefighter lives and first responders, whether it be firefighters or EMS or police officers or even tow truck drivers.
Well, I'd like to take that and also comment and throw back to you that the article that you wrote about the POVs kill back in the November issue of Firehouse certainly stirred up a lot of discussion in on some of the firehouse.com threads, and I think you hit the proverbial home run by exposing some of the things that everyone knows it goes on, but is a lot of times not said and not mentioned. And when an incident does happen, it's kind of like proverbially swept under the rug. And that the commentary that you had there, again, for our listeners, you can go up into the Firehouse forums and in the one section of emergency vehicle operations, you can read some of the commentary that was made as after Brother Mike authored that particular article. To say, Mike, that you got some feedback on that would be an understatement.
Yeah, and it's funny, Tom, I haven't even read any of it, so I need to get on that site and get informed for sure. So what else do you have for us, Tom?
Well, there's also with we mentioned being in the month of December, and we're going to be talking later in the program about cold weather operations. But locally here in upstate New York, where we get some reasonably foul weather many times because of either normal storms that our listeners might be familiar with or the infamous lake effect snowstorms. Within the last couple of days, a City of Buffalo Fire Department ladder truck, while returning to the station after a run, skidded on the road. I'm guessing probably was the conditions with some black ice, and put the truck into a light stand, into a pole. And there was a picture in the local Buffalo newspaper of the light stand, somewhat bent now, wrapped around the top of the ladder of this 100-foot. Rear mount truck. Now, the article didn't go in to state the amount of damage to the unit, but it goes back to the points that Mike and I were talking about earlier with respect to even when, you know, we're not in a response mode. Again, some of the other incidents in FDNY, I guess, were particularly tragic when you think about, you know, the level of, or the perceived level of the nature of the emergency that they were responding to. You would think that coming back from a run, and because you're not operating lights and sirens, that you're in a little bit better of a safety zone, so to speak. And even if the road conditions are appear to be okay, there can still be you know, some hazards out there. So to say that for the, whether you call them the driver, the engineer, the chauffeur, the aerial operator, or whatever your local jurisdiction tags that person that slides behind the steering wheel of your 20 to, you know, 30 ton plus fire truck, you need to have your wits about you all of the time. And I think one of the taglines that I saw that one department brought is they tried to make an analogy between in a volunteer department between the time when you respond from home to get to the station, to arrive at the station, gear up, get on the rig, be seated and belted, make the response, get to the incident, mitigate the incident safely, and return back to the station, restore your equipment, and get back home to your loved ones. They had made the slogan, bring your A game to every run. And we're trying to make an analogy between a sporting event, and maybe football might be a reasonable analogy, that it's a 60-minute timed event, but there's an awful lot of preparation that goes preceding that in terms of physical conditioning and training and studying the game plan and then executing the game plan. And I think we can make some pretty strong parallels between our department SOPs or SOGs and what the game plan for a particular event or type of event might be. And if you just let your guard down for even a quick moment, you many times find out you're on the wrong side of the incident, and now instead of being part of the solution, you and your crew and the apparatus, you're part of the problem. And I can would wager to say none of us plan on having an accident. None of us plan on creating a problem, which in many cases is more serious than the incident we went to. It again, not to keep beating it up, but if you think about the FDNY incident of the squad and the truck responding, you know, to what was reported to be a minor incident, that was probably mitigated rather quickly. Now the incident where you've got, you know, 12 members injured, potentially somebody injured severely or worse, or trapped, and two wrecked pieces of fire apparatus with the civilians and everybody gathering around. I don't think it's too much of a stretch, Mike, to think about. There probably weren't too many onlookers at the incident of the gas leak other than the people that maybe were asked to be evacuated from the building. I'll bet there were plenty of onlookers at the scene of the incident where Squad 18 and Tower Ladder 12 came to blows at the intersection. So in addition to all the internal strife and things we create within our department, now we're dealing with a major accident that we've got to deal with the public and a lot of other investigative agencies that may not necessarily be part of our department, and certainly with the police and other agencies. Now you've got a major incident on your hand that we may not be in control of. So I think it just bears to mind, like those the poor fellows on the ladder company in Buffalo that were returning back to the station after that one run. You're not safe until that rig backs in quarters, you get out, restore your gear and equipment, and maybe get back to the kitchen table to have a cup of coffee or debrief from the incident and talk about what you did well or what may have gone a little bit better. You've got to bring your A game every run, every day. And that's easy to say, but understandably very difficult to do from that point. So, Mike, I know you've got some. We've got some questions from our listeners. What have you got? What do we want to try to handle here in the next couple minutes?
Well, the first one I have is from Phil, and he talks, Tom, about the Jacobs engine brake, the Jake brake, which is the trade name of an engine retarding system as an auxiliary brake. He writes, "Thank you for the podcast, as I enjoy listening to it. I'm a fairly new engineer on a department in Rhode Island. I volunteered 2 years ago, and this is my first winter driving. Can you please help me dispel some of the rumors about the Jacobs engine brake? Are you supposed to use it in the snow? Are you supposed to use it in the ice? Are you supposed to use it in the rain? What are the ideal or no ideal conditions to keep this turned on? Also, can we turn it off while driving, or does it have to be turned on before the truck is fired up?" Well, I think, Tom, I'll start off and answer the last question first. You can turn it on and off as you go, and that's part of the methodology. And right in front of me here, I have the Jake brake on the board operator's manual for a Jacobs engine brake. Let me see if there's a year on this that it was printed. I can't seem to find one. Let's see. 2000. The year 2000, this particular operator's manual for Jacobs engine brake was printed. And on page 10 of that, it talks about driving in slippery pavement conditions. And it says, "Since the operation of any vehicle under slippery condition is unpredictable, be sure you have plenty of distance when testing service brakes or your Jacobs engine brake. The Jacobs engine brake will not affect the operator of an ABS anti-lock brake system on vehicles so equipped. The ABS systems should deactivate the engine brake when wheel slip occurs and traction is lost. and will reactivate the engine brake when ABS system has disengaged. There's a computer system there that if your Jacobs engine brake is hooked into it, if it's a newer model of truck, once the anti-lock brake computer senses that the wheels are going to lock up, it would automatically turn the auxiliary brake system off in milliseconds, much shorter time than any human could do it. And then on the upside is that as soon as the wheels are free spinning again, the engine retarder would then be turned back on again in milliseconds. It goes on to say, if the Jacobs engine brake is new to you, it is recommended that you do not attempt to use it on slippery roads until you have some experience with it on dry pavement. When you have had that experience, you may use the following operational sequence as a guideline. When driving on wet or icy pavement, start with the master switch in the off position, and in the case of an automatic transmission, it would seek the normal gear that you would use under these conditions. Before activating the engine brake, be sure that you have plenty of distance between your vehicle and other vehicles and that traffic conditions allow for the testing of vehicle braking. Also, make sure that the vehicle is maintaining traction and stability using the natural retardation of the engine alone. If the retarding of the engine alone without the engine brake causes any loss of traction, do not attempt to use the engine brake until road conditions improve. If the vehicle is maintaining traction, you may then activate the Jacobs engine brake by turning the switch to the low position. Many of these engine brakes have two and three positions. I know from years ago that if you had a six-cylinder diesel and you put it in the low position, you would get retardation out of three cylinders. And if you had a four-cylinder or eight-cylinder diesel engine, you would get retardation out of four, and then you would switch it on to the high setting, and you would get six and eight on each of those. You turn it on to the low position. If the wheels begin to lock or there is a fishtail motion, immediately turn the switch off and don't use the engine brake until road conditions improve. If there is no tendency for the drive wheels to lose traction and you desire greater slowing power, move the brake switch to the next highest position. If the drive wheels tend to lock or there is a fishtail motion, immediately switch the engine brake into the low position. Do not attempt to use a higher position until road conditions improve. Check your progressive braking switch for proper position often, since road conditions can change quickly. Remember, never skip a step when operating the progressive brake switch. Always go from off to low and then to a higher position. Often, Tom, we get that question even in driving class, and there's a lot of conflicting information because we are taking apparatus that are built by manufacturers that have Jacobs engine brakes and other auxiliary brake systems installed. And there seems to be at times a contradiction where Jacobs puts out this information on how to properly use the device in inclement weather. The manufacturers just put turn it off in slippery conditions. And from the manufacturing sector, can you provide any information for us on why that is or how that occurs, or do you have any insight in that?
Mike, I'm suspecting that's driven by the fact that the manufacturers can't control who gets behind the wheel of their apparatus. All right, now to the point of the gentleman who graciously wrote in his question, here is a fellow that's just started to become a driver, and by his own admission, is going to be going through his first winter of winter driving. That same individual, all right, to get behind the wheel of a fire truck on his next tour, if he's in a volunteer when he gets turned over to operate the vehicle, and have limited experience in poor driving conditions and how that vehicle is going to operate and how it's going to kind of control itself and the handling of that. as compared to Mike, I remember one of the first times I came down to the Bronx and rode with you, and John was driving, and that fella had 30 years on the job and had been driving for the last 12. You're not going to have to tell John what to do. He knows instinctively how that apparatus is going to handle. So for that reason, I think it's not that the manufacturers were running counterculture to what Jacobs is stating, but if you're unfamiliar with how the vehicle is going to handle, and you're correct, that low, medium, high position, since all engines now are six-cylinder engines, you're going to operate in the low position. You're going to get two cylinders. Jake is going to be active on versus four versus six. And every level of that, if you're not familiar with the amount of compression holdback that you get off the Jake in dry pavement conditions, it's true that if you leave it in the high position and you've got the accelerator punched and you start coming upon something where all of a sudden, oh, my God, I've got to slow down. And as soon as you let off the accelerator with the Jake, and if, you're, again, you're not familiar with how the ABS brake system is going to operate on your newer piece of apparatus, and you go to stab the pedal, you're going to put that thing into a skid. So I guess two comments that I have, Mike. One is you can go up and get further information. While Mike was reading out of the Jacobs manual, I Googled Jacobs engine brake, and there they have a very fine website that has a ton of technical information up there once you go through the different parts. And their website is, not surprisingly, jakebrake.com. So we would probably suggest to our listeners that you can go up there and read some of that information and download some of the technical publications they have up on there and become a little bit more familiar. Now, when your fire truck is brand new, again, Mike, from a manufacturer standpoint, the department probably had in their that they wanted two copies of the operating manual for the unit. So somewhere in the fire station should be the service and operating manual, not only for the whole rig, but for the Jacobs engine brake, and you can read the information that went along with that exact make and model of the unit that you happen to be driving. The other suggestion would be, and Mike, you might want to comment and amplify on this, is that if you want to find out how that rig is going to work and how it's going to hold back, the best things you can do is, rather than find out either driving back from a run and changing drivers, or having to, worse yet, find out how your engine or truck operates under poor road conditions, you do that and you start out in a parking lot on a dry day where you can do some driving and see what happens when you go to let off the Jake suddenly and stab the brakes. And you can do the same thing in that big parking lot, as long as there aren't any telephone poles or light stands or anything else in the area, and do that on a day under controlled conditions when there's some snow or ice in the parking lot, and find out how your vehicle operates. Again, with the emphasis of being under the watchful eyes of an experienced driver. There was one upstate New York department, Mike, I think in the past, they'll go nameless because we're not looking to, make the people any more upset than they were, where they took an engine out in a parking lot on a dry day to do some driver training, and unfortunately, the person who was driving, I guess, had very, very limited experience, and he ended up hitting, you can put this under the category of you can't make this stuff up, he hit the accelerator rather than hitting the brake and ended up running over a light stand and the concrete abutment that holds the light stand in the middle of a parking lot. It was the only thing he could hit, and he hit it and did about $70,000 of damage to the vehicle and had to have a good portion of the cab replaced. So when you do this, you want to do it under controlled conditions with your training officer or somebody that's empowered by the department, and not just another driver to say, hey, let's take it out to the local parking lot in the mall and we'll go behind the mall and let's try doing some donuts and see what happens. Not the right thing to do. You want to make sure that it's approved by the department, but emergency vehicle operations, as we're going to be talking about shortly, under bad winter conditions, as I look out the back window of my home right now, the wind's swirling at about 25 to 30 miles an hour. There's 4 to 5 inches of snow on the ground, and it's going to snow the rest of the day. If you've got to go out and drive under conditions like that, You need to know how the vehicle is going to operate before you have to crest out the door. On a day like today, that's not the day to be your first day behind the wheel to find out how the vehicle is going to handle for you.
Right, and that's a point well made, and that's one that I've been trying to hammer home, Tom, for years and years when I go out and do the driving classes. There are some what I call fair-weather fire chiefs that won't let the apparatus out unless it's a 70-degree sunny day in July for driver training. And yet that's the same fire chief that will stand in front of a building at 4 o'clock in the morning with fire out three windows and people trapped and 6 inches of snow cover on the ground with wind blowing and snow howling and want the fire truck to be there yesterday from a driver that just started out driving. And I think that that's just completely unfair, and the expectations of the fire chief are just completely unreal and out of touch.
You know, Mike, I think there's a parallel with what we had just talked about when we mentioned about positioning and operating apparatus safely on highways and what we're going to talk about with the next question on winter weather operations. If you think about it, 5-6 years ago, there were very few departments that had SOPs or SOGs or had any degree of training about how to operate on a limited access highway. We took it that our apparatus would be just as safe if we pulled it out of the bay doors and did an engine company drill where we were stretching lines and maybe hooked up to a plug in front of the firehouse. We would be just as safe there as we went out and if we operated out anywhere on a public roadway under the guise of nobody's going to hit us because we're firemen and it's a big white and red rig and it's got all kinds of lights on it, so we weren't aware that we were putting ourselves in harm's way. It's only because after we had numerous incidents of those things operating out on the highway that heightened awareness happened to come into play. Now, if our listeners, you're sitting here and you're listening to the podcast and you're down in Palm Beach County, Florida, you don't have to worry about what we have been talking about or what we're going to talk about for the next couple of minutes. But if you're anywhere from North Carolina north, or if you look at happen where the weather patterns happen to be this year, I doubt, Mike, this is a good one. I heard when I was out working in Wisconsin the last couple of days that they had snow in Las Vegas and the Las Vegas airport closed, and somebody on a news channel, I don't know whether the number was correct, but said in that entire whole area there were only 12 snow plows, because I don't know how many years, it had been 20 plus years since Las Vegas had snow. And I doubt that the Las Vegas Fire Department or the Clark County Fire Department has ever had to go into winter weather driving characteristics for their engineers out there. But the one day that it does snow, you better be bringing your A game, because you never know when it's going to happen. You know, and for our listeners, Mike and I, for the most of our adult lives, have lived in climates where we enjoy the four seasons. And one of the pains of that is when you get into November, December, January, and where I live, it can be up to April. You got almost 6 months of wet roads, icy roads, and snow. If that's what you could possibly contend with 3, 4, 5, 6 months a year, you ought to invest some time in training your people how to operate under those climatic conditions, because I can assure you it's not always sunny. As Mike said, it's not sunny and 70 degrees 12 months a year in a lot of parts of the country. And again, I think we have that same philosophy that if we make a run at 2 o'clock in the morning on a July night and you know it's you're going to go to work and you got a job, things kind of go smoothly, and you maybe let your guard down a little bit because you're not thinking about, obviously, snow, wet roads, ice, or any of that. That exact same scenario, but fast forward and push it back into November or December, a lot of what you do, you're either limited or maybe completely knocked out of being able to operate in that fashion or with any degree of speed and or precision because you have weather conditions that you have to contend with. And I think we need to heighten the awareness of that, Mike. If we don't, I think if you started plotting maybe where some of the more serious incidents are, they kind of occur with, you just said, well, if the road was slippery, it wasn't my fault. Well, if you go out on a run today in western New York, the way the conditions are, you better expect it. You know, you could take a header just stepping outside the fire station, you know, to get on the rig after the doors close because it's icy. It's just the nature of what we have to deal with.
Right. Absolutely correct, Tom. And you know, we're not talking, folks, about taking your apparatus out in an ice storm or a blizzard. I mean, common sense has to prevail. But if you expect fire apparatus to show up safely and in a fairly timely manner at 4 o'clock in the morning with snow on the ground, then you have to be able to train people in that parking lot, in that controlled environment, to understand how the apparatus works, which brings up the next point with the Jacobs engine brake or any kind of auxiliary brake system, whether you want a Telma, a driveline retarder, or an Allison transmission retarder, or whatever you have on board the truck. You can have an apparatus, many of them made by the same manufacturer, such as we do in the city of New York, and yet they're all made to the same specification by the same vendor with the same components, and yet each one has idiosyncrasies that makes it handle a little bit different. And I'll just go to a quick story. When I drove 56 truck in the Bronx, through snow and rain and everything, I never took the Jake brake off. It just seemed, and then in later years, the Telma retarder, our apparatus were equipped with the driveline retarder, and it just seemed like the truck was so dialed in to the auxiliary brake that I just never lost traction, even in the worst snowstorms. We just never lost traction, and perhaps one of the other reasons is that we, with the snowfall of 4 inches or more, we put chains on the apparatus, a full set of chains, that certainly help with the traction, but I never lost traction. And yet in my volunteer department in Howells, New York, we had a tanker that was built without any kind of auxiliary brake, and the commissioner sent it out to be retrofitted with a Jacobs engine brake. And with that particular apparatus, if the tanker was full and it was a 2,500-gallon tank, you rode with the Jake brake on. If you dumped the water load, we learned very quickly that because of the loss of that weight and the way that the Jake brake was adjusted in the truck, that if you were shuttling water and you were driving along with no water, that you had to shut the engine brake off, even on a dry, sunny day, because it was just dialed in so good for that additional weight that you could get yourself into trouble early and often. So each system, each auxiliary brake system installed in each of the different apparatus may act a little bit differently. So it just all goes back to the training and stuff that you can do before the bell hits and the equipment is needed in inclement weather, to do as much pre-planning and as much training as you possibly can to understand each of the apparatus in your fleet. And right now, let's take a quick break. This is Tom Shan and Mike Wilbur at firehouse.com. And just a reminder that you too could get your questions answered on the show if you get online and go to podcast@firehouse.com and just submit your questions to the apparatus architect, and we'll make sure that we get your questions on the air. We'll be right back.
Radio at firehouse.com. Real issues, real answers, real firefighters.
TFT has the industry's broadest line of fire suppression equipment, yet everyone thinks we're just nozzles. Sure, we've got all the fixed, selectable, and automatic handheld nozzles you'd ever want, but we also have great foam injection and application equipment, amazing manual and remote control monitors, high-flowing intake valves, and leak-proof suction hose. So if you're specking a new apparatus, go to www.tft.com or give us a call at 800-348-2686. TFT makes over 2,300 products. We're not just nozzles anymore.
And welcome back. This is the Apparatus Architects with Tom Shan and Mike Wilbur. And we're going to continue today with another question. And this question comes from Charles out on Long Beach, New York. We just started a major renovation, Tom, of one of our firehouses, which requires us to put the trucks in a commercial garage that is not heated. Last night, the pump on the engine froze. Would your technical people know if there is an additive that can be added to the water in the tank of the engine truck to prevent freezing? Thank you for any suggestions you might be able to provide. What do you have for us, Tom?
Well, Mike, that's a good question. It's a, you know, not all that common that we're taking our engine apparatus, you know, and putting them inside an unheated garage. But just in general, I touched base on the subject because it is one of the things that has been kind of like the Jake break, is an on or off, and talking to people in different departments in different parts of the country in terms of the concept of draining all of the water out of the pump and thinking that that's going to prevent any major damage to the unit. Now, it is possible, certainly, you can open up every drain valve, open up the master drain, remove the caps from the suction inlets, which typically are obviously the lower part of the pump to make sure all the water is drained out. You can then take an air hose off a small air compressor and blow out the remaining water and maybe even add some antifreeze to the pump. And while that might protect the fire pump itself, and that it's, you're not going to get a solid block of ice and it's not going to freeze and crack the pump casing, some of the downsides of that are as follows. It is virtually impossible to remove all of the moisture out of the fire pump. So you still can have some ice formations inside the pump, which may or may not damage, the internal workings of anything. If your tank to pump valve is not tight and happens to leak by, any effort you make to take and drain all of the water out of the pump is not going to help you, because you're going to leak water past the tank to pump valve. Leaving all of the drains open, then if you have a response, and if you're thinking about this, you now need to close all the drains, because if you leave them open, by the time you have any type of long response in cold weather, again, for the listeners, I was up in Wisconsin working this week, and the high temperature on one day was 4 degrees above. When I got up in the morning, it was 15 below. So you take a couple-mile run at those temperatures and you left any of the drains open, they're going to remain open because there's going to be some residual moisture in there, and it's going to freeze. So having said that, I have spoken over the course of the last couple weeks to people in different departments in Michigan and in Wisconsin, where they constantly get very, very cold, extended cold streaks where it is below zero. And to a person, every one of them said they kept the fire pumps, now this is in the station and obviously at the scene, kept the pumps wet. And the most important thing was to immediately, upon arriving at the scene of an incident, engage the pump and begin to circulate water, which is not a very difficult technique at all. The advice we gave Charles was that while maybe draining the pump, blowing all the air out, and adding some antifreeze may protect the pump, it is impossible, as most of our listeners would be aware of getting all of the residual moisture out of the gauges and the gauge lines and some of the other accessories. So if you found yourself having to store your fire truck in an unheated building for any period of time, while there are some precautions you can take to lessen the impact and the extent of the repairs on the vehicle, you're still going to expect that if that rig had to be housed like that, you're going to go in there and a couple of days later, you're going to see one of your pressure gauges, and instead of the needle on the pressure gauge being down on the pin or registering at zero, it's probably going to be up around 200 to 300 PSI. Why? Because there was water inside the board-on tube, inside the gauge. There is no drain for that. When that froze, it expanded the tube, and once you do that, you're buying a new gauge. So, Mike, the best advice could be, if that is your only option, you better have a pretty healthy maintenance budget, because you're going to end up spending a couple hundred, if not thousands, of dollars to repair some of the other things on the vehicle that just because you couldn't get all the water out of everything. Fire trucks are very complicated pieces of machinery. They're not candidly designed to sit in unheated locations. That brings us to, once you get to the scene of the incident, you need to immediately, even if you're not going to be involved with firefighting activities and it's an automobile accident and you're rendering aid and comfort to the victims and trying to stabilize the scene of the emergency or working at a pin job, you need to immediately engage the fire pump, circulate water through the pump, and keep water going. If attack lines go out, You need to keep water flowing through those, which might be difficult after the fire gets knocked down, that you need to take the nozzle and stick it out a window so you don't do any more damage and keep water flowing through that line even a little bit. Failing that, you're going to potentially freeze up the nozzle, particularly if it happens to be a fog nozzle or something that has mechanisms in it that where you don't have a smooth waterway, that's going to freeze up. Any kind of nozzle is going to freeze up. If you take the nozzle and you come outside, you back the line out of the building where, you know, Mike's middle of July on a hot, steamy night, you might take the nozzle and lay the nozzle on the ground. Last thing you want to do is have the line shut, take the nozzle, lay the nozzle down in the snow or the ice will guarantee you. These things and the water in the lines as well, particularly if we're talking about small diameter attack lines, these things can freeze up in a period of less than 2 minutes, all right, to the point where it would render the line inoperable to be used again. So the movement of the water and the circulating of the water is paramount. A couple of other things you can do on a pumper, to either if you're buying new or retrofitting, and if you're concerned that you need to heat that area, there are options available. You can put a heat pan, which is just simply a almost looks like a drip pan that bolts up underneath the pump enclosure and keeps heat up in that area, particularly with the new generation of engines. They are throwing off a lot more ambient heat off the muffler and the DPF, so you've almost got like a built-in heat sink there. Another thing you can do, which is, again, that most manufacturers offer, is to put a pump heater in there, which typically is either a electric heater or a hot water heater with some designs, and put up into the pump enclosure to blow warm air into that area. So those are two things that you can do to add, but the most important thing is to make sure the pump, prior to the cold weather hitting, the drains are all operable, they're tight. You've got a good seal in the pump. Your pump packings and your mechanical seal is operational and working well, and that you immediately upon arriving at the scene of the incident engage the pump and begin to circulate water. If you do that and you have everything else working well, Mike, you're probably not going to damage your unit. Now, with the ladder truck, I'm kind of out of my area, so we're going to throw it back to you. On aerial devices, what are some of the things that you've got to think about for wintertime operations? You got no water to freeze other than the can, so I'm guessing maybe the can man's job is to run around the building and keep water sloshing in there so that doesn't freeze. What else you guys got to worry about? I think everything seems to be pretty simple.
Well, when we get hooked up to an engine, we have water problems just like engines do, unfortunately. And then, of course, with Quinn apparatus, we have it all going on. A couple of things to note. If you're operating in periods of extreme cold, and you're the incident commander, when you determine that this fire is out, you need to be able to bed the ladder, open all the drains, get all the water out of it, and bed it, and get it back to the firehouse and start getting it thawed out. And there's no do-overs. Once you, as the incident commander, determine that this unit's going to stop flowing water, you need to get it, get the drains open, get the water out of it, and get it bedded and get it back and get it warm and get it starting to thaw out. If you don't do that, then the alternative is that you may end up having the thing frozen up in the air, or you could try to retract the ladder or the tower and blow out the seals in the waterway, which is going to be a fairly expensive repair as well. And if water weighs 8 pounds a gallon, one would assume that ice would weigh 8 pounds a gallon as well. And one of the things that we teach in aerial ops classes is that, and tower classes, is that when you're operating particularly a waterway and the wind is blowing and you get below freezing temperatures and the ice starts to accumulate on your bucket or your boom or the aerial, you want to retract and extend that often and break up any accumulations of ice so that you don't overload the ladder or the boom with ice. That's important as well. I remember one fire that I was at in the bitter cold years ago where we didn't get the tower down fast enough, and the company had to stay and await a thawing unit. And the thawing unit was nothing more than a big portable steam jenny, and they had to basically steam clean the apparatus in a freezing cold to try and get the ice off of it so that they could get the tower rebedded again. And then another concern, and again, it can happen with an aerial, but it's more likely to happen with a tower, is a term that we call poling or pole vaulting, where the apparatus is parked and set up on a hill. And if the jacks and the outriggers and the stabilizing feet aren't in contact with the ground and should get snow under it or get ice under it or get up on top of ice, the apparatus will just simply slide down the hill. Some of our better companies out there in the city of New York will carry 50 pounds of rock salt with them and put that ice-melting rock salt around the outriggers and jacks to make sure that the outriggers and jacks and the plates all stay in firm contact with the ground. And a lot of times what you see is that problems won't happen initially, but over time, as the water spray and the water runoff go under the apparatus and start to freeze, and then particularly if you have the boom at 0 degrees and off to the side perpendicular to the apparatus can then oftentimes jump up onto the ice and then start to slide away. One of the things that you should do if you're in the bucket is to get the bucket aligned back with the chassis again to get all of the weight equally distributed on the jacks, and that may tend to slow you down or stop you. It doesn't happen often, but when it does, you'll have body parts puckering up on you didn't even know that you had before as you're out there off to the side in the basket and see yourself sliding down a hill. If it makes you feel good, I suppose you could go jump up behind the wheel and put your foot on the brakes, even though the wheels aren't really in contact with the ground, but there's very little that you can do once it gets that far. So the best fix for that is to make sure that the jacks stay in contact with the ground. And as an operator, you have a responsibility to get up off the pedestal and do a 360 around the rig every 20 or 30 minutes or so in an extended operation. And this goes for winter or summer. Many apparatus have failed when the water runoff has come out, undermined the apparatus jacks and outrigging system, and then the thing flops over in a heap, you know, 2 or 3 hours into the fire. And I think up in Buffalo, there was an apparatus that was at a 6 or 7 hour fire, and it was a rear-mounted tower. Do you remember the pictures of that, Tom, where way into the fire it all of a sudden ended up topsy-turvy?
Yeah, Mike, I believe it was an incident. I don't think I have all of the specifics, but I believe it was an incident where it was operating at a like you said, for several hours at a abandoned warehouse factory. The unit was operating in like a vacant parking lot, you know, to get a good position, which was a smart thing to do, you know, rather than just leaving it in the street and say, hey, chief, I guess we can't use the tower tonight. Well, after several hours of operation and the water runoff from the building, I believe, undermined one of the outriggers and caused the unit to tip into the building, as I believe that the case was. But no matter what the specifics of that incident are, Mike is absolutely correct. It is incumbent, whether you're operating an aerial apparatus, particularly if it's a tower ladder, and you've got personnel operating up in the bucket area, to constantly monitor the conditions around the unit with respect to the outriggers. And for, you know, the engine company folks, it's this be the same thing. Since it's going to be logical that there we are obviously dealing with water, and we're going to be dealing with icing conditions, having that rock salt available, if you're not friends with the neighboring ladder company and they happen to have that, that might not be a bad thing to consider keeping some of that on the engine. If nothing else, to keep the area around the cab where members might be getting in and out of it to the rehab or warm up or get into a warm, you know, grab another warm pair of gloves or something, and for the chauffeur that's operating around the area of the pump handle, to rock salt that area to keep it so it's safe, so you don't have to worry about taking a header as soon as you get, you know, 2 or 3 feet away from the apparatus. And again, it's almost to me, Mike, it's like the old Boy Scout model. You want to be prepared here. You know, it shouldn't come as a surprise that if you crest out of the station on a run, even if you were maybe a little bit naive and you weren't sure what the road conditions were, that if you, as you're leaving the ramp and you notice that the streets are totally snow-covered, the plow may or may not have come through. That is a big deal in a lot of cities where they have one-way streets, and even if the parking's only on one side, that just access to the block into the area where you might be going itself is going to be restricted. I remember, again, going back to hearing some war stories from folks both not only in the Syracuse area where I lived for many years, but here in Western New York on some of these narrow streets, of talking about companies that couldn't make it into the block because of snow drifts or blocked vehicles that were abandoned by the public, and where companies were hoofing it in by a block with the guys on the engine carrying the standpipe packs or breaking a rear attack line or a cross lathing and carrying the hose in to work off an adjacent hydrant or maybe one of the companies that could get into the block, and then everyone else was just physically unable to get in there because of snow conditions. So that's the kind of thing, kind of difficult to prepare and train for that as compared to preparing and training for driving operations in a parking lot under something of control conditions. Like Mike said, now, not going to do this when it's 15 degrees below zero just to see how soon it takes water to freeze or how long people can last, but do it when it makes sense so that your people are prepared as much as possible for what the winter weather conditions can throw at you. So
I had one more point on that. You just brought something up to mind, another winter operation that we have in ladder companies in New York. If the building is less than 4 stories, we allow the engines to get in with the idea that we can take portable ladders and kind of using them like sleds and be able to ladder the building. But if the building is over 4 or more stories, then the engine stays and they stretch the hose from afar, and the truck tries to make the block to use the aerial or the tower when it's a higher building. That just came to mind, and I thought I'd like to share that with our listeners.
So, thanks, Mike. And last topic for our podcast, Mike, would you like to give us an update? I know you and several folks, noteworthy folks, have been working extremely hard on seatbelt initiative, as it's become the known, with not only getting folks measured up with, so we have an idea as to what the average firefighter really is from a sizing perspective, but to try to make it a little bit safer for us on the inside of the cab. So can you give us a quick update? What's going on in that area?
Thanks, Tom. Yeah, there's been a lot of activity of late. Jennifer Whitestone from Total Contact finished phase 2 of the report. The findings are due out in January. We have some initial findings and can pretty much confirm what I think anybody that's put on bunker gear and gotten into the back of one of these trucks has faced over the course of the last 10 or 15 or 20 years. There's just simply not enough room. The standard says that there needs to be 18 inches of seat and 22 inches of shoulder room. From the science, from the pure science, from body scanning people, firefighters in bunker gear, the minimum really that's going to need to be required at a minimum is somewhere in the 23 to 24 inch range. So we're not even close, and as time goes on, more of these findings are going to come out and just confirm, I think, what a lot of us already knew who have to ride in fire trucks with bunker gear. We have good news that we have gotten a grant from NIOSH, through NIOSH, and Dr. Hongwei, a PhD in charge of anthropomology there, is going to be the lead in phase three of our study, where we are going to take mobile body scanners, head scanners, and hand scanners, and we are going to go to four locations throughout the country to get those subjects that are required to give everybody voice and input into this study and get them accounted for. Some of the stories that we're hearing, a female firefighter in Texas who couldn't put a seatbelt on when she drove. Why? Because the configuration of the seat and the fact that she was a little under 5 foot, she couldn't reach the pedals unless she sat at the edge of the seat to drive the pumper. And so that and many other sizing issues are certainly going to be addressed as we proceed with phase three of our study. This phase of the study is going to take about 4 years. We're working through the methodology now. We have picked four sites. One is going to be in Fort Worth, Texas, to get firefighters, both career and volunteer, from the Metroplex. We have another site that's going to be in Phoenix, headed up by Kevin Roach, and our site in Fort Worth is going to be headed up by Captain Homer Robertson. A third site is going to be in the Chicago, Illinois area to get those firefighters that are from the Central Plains and Midwest, and that site's going to be headed up by Forrest Reeder. And then our fourth site is going to be at Montgomery County in Maryland, in the Baltimore, D.C. Area of the East Coast, and that site is under the direction of interim chief, Richie Bowers, and a couple of his folks are going to be handed that project off, and we're going to get firefighters sized and measured there. Our hope is, as far as the timeline, that in the fourth quarter of this year, after October 1st, that we are going to be at one of these sites, and we're going to start gathering data for this very important part, the last piece of this puzzle, to gather information. And I think, Tom, it's going to have a dramatic effect on almost everything that we do in the fire service and that we wear. Tools and tool handles, grab handles on the apparatus, our bunker gear, helmets, gloves, shoes, slipping surfaces, the size of surfaces, the size of handrails, and how they're put on the apparatus, and obviously seats and seat belting, and how many people can safely ride in an apparatus. All these are going to be addressed. And it comes really, I think, at a very pivotal point in time when in 2010 we have the next round of the EPA emission standards. And, of course, the engines are going to be, by most accounts, a little bit bigger and take up more room. And so I think between both of these things happening simultaneously that you're going to see some pretty interesting redesigns of cabs in order to be able to fit everybody and everything.
Well, Mike, I think that's really going to be quite helpful. And while some people might think that four years is painfully slow, if we look at how long it's taken the fire service to get to this point with a lot of things, that's within the normal cycle time of a less cycle time than it is to review and revise one of the NFPA standards. So, I just my hat is off to the folks that you've worked with and all of the hard work that you and folks like Jay Gordon Routley have put into this. And just for the benefit of our listeners, again, those folks that are listening to us from the sunny climates, one of my favorite expressions during the wintertime is when the weatherman is telling you the forecast and predicting virtual whiteout conditions. Well, as I look out my home back window into my backyard right now. I can't see the fence line off the back of my house, which is probably no more than about 60 to 70 feet off the back of my house. So if those are the kind of conditions that you have in your community, I think you might want to adhere to some of the things that Brother Mike and I have talked about today. And maybe difficult to try to get, you know, your fire chief or maybe you're the, you know, the duty chief that on a day where it's, you know, in the 20s and saying, hey, you know, we got a couple new guys into the station and, you know, they're going to be working on driving to convince them to go take the rig out and go into a secure parking lot with some cones and to be able to practice driving under somewhat of controlled conditions. You know, it's, I've heard many, many stories of people saying the chief says, ah, now we'll just, you know, we'll handle that on the next run, you know, and that, unfortunately, that attitude is what gets us in the trouble when we just think that we can handle anything and everything that's thrown at us without having to prepare a little bit. So for our listeners from Tom Shand, it's the holiday season, and we wish all of our listeners and the readers of Firehouse Magazine a very safe and happy holiday season. And to you, Brother Mike, any last parting thoughts?
Yes, I'd like to extend my good holiday wishes to all our listeners as well. And as with you, as I look outside, it looks like it's snowing at about a rate of an inch an hour, and we live about 6 hours apart. So we're all going to get a significant weather event today along the East Coast. And just want to make sure that everybody out there heeds this very important message and that they stay safe and have a happy holiday season.
All right, so from Tom Shand and Mike Wilbur, the Apparatus Architects, I'd like to thank everyone for listening in. And if you have any other questions or things you'd like us to handle on during our podcast, please send them into podcast@firehouse.com. So until the next time, to our listeners, stay safe out there. We look forward to meeting you out during the coming year. Thanks very much.
If you have a comment on this program, drop us a line at radio@firehouse.com. Thanks for listening, and stay tuned to firehouse.com for more broadcasts like these, or visit our website at www.firehouse.com/radio.